Members, we don't have quorum yet, but let's get started on hearing the discussion on House File 2936, and we can call the meeting to order when we do get quorum. So with that, Representative Backer, welcome to the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee, and Mr. Wold, thank you both for coming. Representative Backer, if you would like to introduce House File 2936, so we can move it when we do get quorum.
Yes, thank you, Chair and members. House File 2936, there's a provision in the tax code that makes egg containment tax exempt. And I learned about this summer. We had one of the implement dealers in Herman, Minnesota, called and said that why would these properties be exempt. Of course, his concerns, along with several other residents in Grant County and now Travers and Stevens that I've heard from, is wondering why they are exempt, where we have fixed income individuals and businesses now will have to pick up the difference because of that. This law, and Alan will give you a history, has been on the books since 1992, but not all counties have assessed it. So there was not uniformity through the state, and then this year the Commissioner of Revenue has made a decision, sent out a letter to all the assessors in the 87 counties saying we need to enforce this. So with that said, we have quite a few testifiers here today. Let's begin with Alan Wold. He's a taxpayer, farmer, and serves on several boards, to give really the 40-year history of this so everybody has a good basis for it. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Backer. And members, we do not have House File 2936 before us, so this is really going to be informational. And this is an issue that was discussed in the Senate last year, and they actually do have a provision in their side or in their tax bill that's sitting before the Tax Conference Committee at this time that deals with this. And as we understand it, the language we see here is essentially what they have in their bill. Basically, I think this repeals the exemption.
Yep.
And it's a difficult issue, and our hope, members, is that we'll hear about it, get a good understanding of the issue today, have some ideas maybe from all parties on the issue, and then we'll have everybody go back into the workshop and then hopefully come back either next week or the week after with one or two proposals that we can bring forward to have that further discussion in that tax conference committee. Have at least the conferees in the House informed by the discussion we have here in that tax conference committee as we work to resolve that in that forum. So that's kind of where we're at. Ms. Schill, and then Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair and members, in your packet also, you have an amendment, the A1 amendment. You cannot move that because we don't have possession of the bill, but the A1 amendment would change this bill for fiscal year purposes. It would update it. And so the pay 2015 would be pay 2016, which is mirroring the update that the Senate has in its side of the bill. So that gives you better information. And why is that important? Because the fiscal note that you have, revenue estimate that you have for this bill dated March 28, 2016, reflects that A1 amendment. So the revenue estimate has an impact of $150,000 in each year in the tails. And so that estimate is drafted to an updated version of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the questions just keep coming. Thank you for clarifying the process, because I was wondering what the process forward was for this bill, given that the tax bill is already in conference. So my first question, I think, will be, what is the status of conference committee? I may not have been paying attention, but I haven't heard meetings announced on the floor by Chair Davids. When does the public get to see a conference committee?
Representative Dabney, I don't know the answer to that, but soon is, I think, everybody's hope. We're I think, getting close. Staff is lining up the dates, the effective dates, and those type of details on many of the provisions, all the provisions that need to be adjusted within the bill. And I haven't heard any more than you, but we will. I'm hopeful by next week we'll know. But the Tax Conference Committee has not met. The conferees in the House have met with staff twice to look at that task of adjusting those dates and providing staff some guidance in, you know, which fiscal year should these apply to, et cetera, when should they be in the analysis that they're doing. And so that's all the activity that I'm aware of the committee has had, is the conferees have met with staff here, and there's no discussion yet about a particular date for the conference committee, but like you, I'm hopeful that happens soon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's helpful, and it bridges over to my next question that Ms. Schill kind of touched on. Last year's bill obviously had effective dates for 2015 for many of the provisions, and the provisions were scored accordingly. The world has moved on. Will all of the revenue estimates be rescored for 2016? For the deliberations of the conference committee, so that we've got up-to-date numbers and projections?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was attempting to describe. Scoring it is the right word. Okay. And so that should be coming forward very soon, and when that's ready on the House side, I think we should be ready to meet, as far as I understand. I think the Senate was probably further ahead of us in that scoring, but we should be caught up with them very soon.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hertas has a question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, Representative Dabney brings up a good point, the relevancy of a lot of the provisions within the omnibus tax bill, and they're date-sensitive, written for last year, and so there are certain pieces that are probably in there that, you know, need to be updated as well. And I've certainly talked to the chair with regard to a couple of things that I was carrying that was district specific in terms of helping out. So I guess I too would want to be aware at minimum that the changes that we need to make it relative to a possible tax bill this year would be correctly stated.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hertas, and we will share that additional information with the committee when it comes forward, so it should be very soon. With that, members will call the meeting to order. We do have quorum, and we also have a set of minutes here. The chair would entertain a motion to approve the minutes, if there is one. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval of the minutes for March 23.
Moved by Representative Erickson to move the March 23rd, 2016 minutes. Any additions, corrections, or discussion on the minutes for March 23rd? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are approved as presented. Mr. Wold, welcome. And again, members, we do not have the bill before us, so we will not be moving it today. But Mr. Wold, welcome, and look forward to your discussion. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Alan Wold, Wheaton, Minnesota. Chairman Drzeskowski and the rest of the committee. Just going to give you a brief history of 40 years. I started farming in 1976, and in those days when we bought chemicals, they came in a 2.5-gallon sealed jug, and you could get two in a box, and you'd have 5 gallons. That was bulk. That was quite an upgrade from my father, where you bought it 1 gallon at a time. The sprayer I had that I was very proud of was actually 40 feet wide. People would mount them in pickups, and even the elevator, when they did custom sprayer, used 40-foot wide equipment. We did not raise much corn at that time for reasons of price and other things. And the primary things raised were sunflowers and barley and wheat, and the fertilizer requirements were much less than it is with corn. Over the years, farmers grew larger in operations, and I remember with great pride getting a 100-gallon container that I could buy bulk chemical in, and it had even a very accurate little meter because the companies wanted us to use their product, and I was glad to buy their product just to get the little metering device.
Thank you.
And at that time, since it was more bulk, you could still buy them in 5-gallon cans at a time or boxes. Semis coming in with 6,000 gallons of chemical started to come in. And there were tanks in the fertilizer plants, but there really was no containment if there was a spill. Now, really, if you dropped a box with two and a half gallon plastic jugs, you never worried about it rupturing or anything. So there was no containment structures at that time. So it was a great fill to give fertilizer companies, your co-ops, an incentive to put up a containment structure. There really were no rules. Right now, the EPA has all these rules in place now, and they have to be followed. The sprayers we have now are 120 to 150 feet. So to have a 1,000 or 2,000 gallon tank is not uncommon and probably normal. The other thing that came was when we started raising more corn, we used liquid fertilizer, which was never used before. So that comes in semi-loads, and that's put in upright tanks, and there was no containment around them if they were to spill. Wheaton Dumont just built a new fertilizer plant, and it was toured by Chairman Kurt Dowd. And when you go in, you don't really see a containment structure per se, but when you walk in, you kind of walk up a ramp and go down a ramp because the walls are like a foot and a half tall, and the whole building is a containment structure. And you look, what you'd see would be a sump or a drain in the middle of the floor, and you think, aha, so when it spills, it's going to go down the creek. All that is a sump pit so that you can hose it down and suck it out there, but it's all completely enclosed. So I was visiting with the manager of the fertilizer and chemical plant in Wheaton, and I said, how are the laws, what laws do you work under? He said, this is all federal, this is all EPA. So the tax breaks given to the elevators or sellers of fertilizer and chemical have really outlived their usefulness. At the time, they were an excellent idea. It was great. It was needed. But now, in a sense, we're rewarding people for not speeding. So if you speed, you pay a fine. But right now, it's almost like at the end of the year, since you didn't speed, you get a reward. The problem is some of these subsidies, like in Herman, amount to almost $100,000. Naturally, a fertilizer company does not like to give those up. But that burden within the town of Herman, when they built it, they did not build a fertilizer plant for the tax benefits. I can assure you that. There was a demand and a need for it. And farming has changed a lot in 40 years, and they've gone with the times. But people on fixed incomes and other businesses have to pick up the slack. And it isn't that, you know, I hate to say it, I'm a member of a co-op. We can't afford it. And I don't like to see other people paying what I should probably be paying myself. But that's how the law reads. So that's it in a nutshell. Things have changed dramatically in 40 years, and the need for the law when it was passed in 92 was well thought out, much needed, but the days are over.
Thank you, Mr. Wold. Mr. Wold, when the law was passed in 92, did it then apply to the entire building?
No. What you could do, and what companies would often do, where they had tanks, they would either put up a stainless steel, they'd build a tank within the building and then put it around existing large storage tanks, or if it was liquid fertilizer that could be stored outside, even in cold weather, they would build a cement wall around it. So it was retrofitted is what they did. But there was an incentive to do it.
Okay, thank you. Members, questions for Mr. Wold? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe just a comment. Yeah, you're correct in how things have changed in agriculture, but I would say that the need for this type of structure has even grown over the years because, as you mentioned, if you spilled a 5-gallon pail of Treflan 40 years ago, there were implications, but today if a 5,000-gallon tank ruptures, the dangers of that contamination are much greater. So I would say that I think there's got to be some kind of a compromise we can reach here, that the actual containment part of a building is even more needed today because of the larger amounts of a possible spill. And I hope we can work together and to come up with something to, yeah, I don't agree that the entire building should be tax exempt, but the actual containment walls, or as you mentioned, the sump, or this would be held to be pumped out. I think with the larger volumes we're talking about today, that's more important than ever, and we need to work together on this.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mr. Wald, do you have a response?
I'd just like to comment, Chairman and Mr. Anderson. Your point is very well taken, except that the EPA requires it anyway. And Minnesota Department of Ag also has a hand in it. But your point is well taken.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Representative Backer and Mr. Wald, thank you. We will, you'll stay tuned if we have more questions of you or more thoughts. And we'll have next Mr. Carlson and Mr. Carlson and Mr. Carlson.
Okay.
And Ms. Hazleton. Kelly Pearson and Greg Hansen I've got on the list, so if you all are here, we'd be interested in hearing your thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, members,
Mr.
I guess
Carlson.
I'm the first Mr. Carlson. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the greater Minnesota counties containing the regional centers and 4 suburban counties. And I'm also speaking on behalf of AMC today. I want to indicate our support of this legislation. As has been noted, this is already in the Tax Conference Committee. We think it's particularly appropriate given what's happening out in greater Minnesota right now. As many of you who represent that area know, with the decline in commodity prices, land values have been catching up with that and also suffering declines in the last few years. So they're already suffering losses in tax base, and anything that will help moderate that is helpful. As has also been noted, at the time this was enacted, there weren't specific regulations that called for that. Since then, the EPA requirements, as well as the own state laws under Chapters 18D and I believe 18 E require these containment facilities to be provided. There's also an equity issue here that the same facilities, were they to be at a manufacturing facility for the precursor chemicals that are used, are taxable. So there is an equity argument that for this legislation to go forward. With that, I'll conclude. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Carlson, too. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Backer's bill today. I'm going to tee it up for a couple of mayors and a city administrator.
Full introduction, Mr. Carlson.
I'm sorry. Gary Carlson, League of Minnesota Cities. That's a bad mistake, Mr. Chair. When this first came out, or the survey was released by the Department of Revenue, we contacted many of the communities across the state that were impacted, and we were surprised to find that many of them were unaware that the that this could happen if the exemption were to go through and that they would lose significant amounts of their tax base. So we've been spending time trying to alert our cities to the impact of the exemption. And I've provided to you in the packet today a copy of a printout that does rank order the cities by tax base loss and the counties that those are located in, and also a copy of the Department of Revenue survey memo that summarizes some of the issues related to this exemption. Just to note, it was enacted in in 1992 originally, and at that time we had, I think, 24 exemptions carved out in 27202, and now we have 99 exemptions carved out of state law for various property types. But the interpretation and application of this one exemption has grown tremendously, and as you can see on that printout that we've provided, the Department of Revenue estimates that about $112 million of value would be exempted under the department rules if the legislature does not take action to support Representative Backer's bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to a couple of cities that are impacted by this proposal or by the bill in a positive way if you decide to move forward with it. I have with us today Mayor Kelly Pearson from the city of Winthrop, Mayor Greg Hansen from the city of Walnut Grove, and also Jenny Hazelton from the city of Winthrop, who would like to express their support for the bill and tell you how it impacts their cities.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Good morning, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Kelly Pearson. I am the current mayor of Winthrop, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm just going to start out here. We actually, Jenny, who was our city administrator, went to the county to get some clarification on another matter where it was clarification for an assessment with our ethanol plant where we lost approximately $75,000 in funds. And at that time, she was notified that next year we're going to be losing more. So that piqued our interest, and this is when we found out that the A containment, the companies in Winthrop were going to be getting an exemption. We have three large companies in Winthrop. Winthrop's our economy is egg-based, of course, and this would be a tremendous, make a tremendous impact on our city. It's about 12, almost 13% of our budget that we would lose, and it would increase property taxes for the average person close to 30%. For $10 to $15 an hour jobs, that's a huge impact in our community. The city, when we went in, we have an industrial park that we put a lot of money into, $1.1 million, which is a lot of money to the city of Winthrop. To attract these companies to our city, and it did well. We have the companies here. They've been doing fine. We put the money in, assuming that they would be paying their taxes to help offset those costs and to ease the tax burden on our residents. So with that assumption, we have invested a great amount into our industrial park and into accommodating these companies. Along with that, we also have a fire department that is geared up to handle chemical fires. It's very dangerous having chemicals in and around the town, and our fire department is geared up for it and they are prepared for it, but there's additional costs involved in that also that the city has also picked up. Some of the things that I'm going to let Jenny speak about right now is going to be the more of a financial impact on our community. So go ahead, Jenny.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Welcome, Ms. Hazelton, if you could introduce yourself. And
my name is Jenny Hazelton. I'm the city administrator for the city of Winthrop. We're a town of about 1,400 people, and we've always, you know, since we've built up our industrial park, we've kind of prided ourselves that we have some of the lowest taxes in Sibley County due to our investment in our industrial park. We invested in infrastructure. We, you know, encouraged companies to come and build here. So this would be a tremendous loss to our city. It'd be devastating to our residents, you know, to have to pick up that additional cost. And, you know, we did build our industrial park based on the fact that this would help reduce taxes and increase jobs. And we want to be good neighbors. We want, you know, to work with the companies out there, but we also want to do what's best for our citizens in Winthrop.
Thank you, Ms. Hazelton. Members, questions for Mr. Carlson, or Ms. Hazelton and Mr. Pearson at this point? Okay, Mr. Hansen, I'm wondering if the pages, could you grab another chair, guys, and pull them out there, and we'll give a little more room for the people. Thank you. Mr. Hansen, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. I'm Greg Hansen, Mayor of Walnut Grove. Thank you for having us and giving us this opportunity this morning to talk a little bit. You know, it's something Most of us from a small town, we don't get this opportunity. I guess it's an opportunity. I'm thankful for we get a chance to at least express our concerns here. We're far enough out, and we rely on a lot of other people to help us make good decisions and lead us down whatever road it is here. And I think that's a lot what we're looking at today here. The impact of a cut like this, Walnut Grove loses about 10% of its assessed market value out there. That's huge for a small town. We don't have a lot of industry, and I think a lot of the towns on this same list are the same way. If anything that's going to change in our tax base is going to go back to the homeowners. And we have a lot of town of 800 people, a lot of jobs in town. Many of them drive 30 miles to work, minimum pay jobs, but it's a it's still a reasonable place to live. Something like this is going to be devastating on their homeownership. We have a huge influx of Hmong families in Walnut Grove, probably own 30% of our houses and stuff in town, and definitely they drive out of town for work. They do own a business in town, but nobody's getting rich by any means there. And all of a sudden, to change this tax structure to the extent we're looking at here, it's going to be very hard for it. Our local co-op is the one that has a tremendous facility out there, but when we take $1.7 million off of our tax base, it's going to make quite a difference. They're one of our largest employers around. And I think it's a great facility and everything. To me, things have been going this way for so long, and I agree, the rules as they were set up originally probably made a lot of sense. And maybe now it's time to take a look and make the corrections that will make this piece for everybody. Nobody wants pollution. Everybody wants protection of sorts, and I guess I think I can agree with all of that. But this, what's happening here, if we don't repeal it, is going to be very, very hard on a small town. When you have a handful of businesses and without the manufacturing or a lot of places, where's it going to go? It's going to the homeowners, and they're going to feel that a lot in our small town. Again, we're like all the towns, too. You have to ramp up somewhat when you have this type of facility in town. You've got to have a fire department. You do the extra training. A lot of the people that work at our local elevator are also on that fire department. So it's all a small community type of stuff out there. What's fair, and how do we fix this problem so it works for everybody? And I guess I trust in you people to be able to do that for us and make good choices for us. I would sure ask for your help on this.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. And Mr. Hansen, I think that's where we're at. We were looking for some solutions going forward, and there's been some differences in communities and how the law has been applied, and that's kind of what brings us here today. So appreciate that. Any questions, members, for this cluster of folks that have come up here just recently? And you will be here if people have questions as we proceed through. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. May, Mr. Heck, and Mr. Dibing. The assessor team has arrived.
Yes. We're here.
Thank you for coming. Mr. May, do you want to lead it off?
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Tom May. I'm the retired Hennepin County assessor, and I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. With me today are Tom Dibing from Houston County and Steve Hacken from Winona County, who are experts in this area. 27203 sub 23, it has been mentioned, it's been around since 1992. And assessors have always looked at this as a exemption that exempts those secondary confinement facilities, meaning catch basins and concrete berms and those kind of facilities that are put in, but have never really looked at it as an exemption for buildings in their entirety. That's the way it's been until 1975, when the Department of Revenue did a analysis and sent out a directive that basically included the structures and the buildings. And that, again, we've talked about it, has that $112 million impact across the state, and that was based on a survey that was done last fall by the Department of Revenue with the counties. We are supportive of the bill in its state or a compromise that would specifically identify those types of concrete berms or catch basins that are exempt and not exempt the structures or the wider interpretation as it came out last year. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Hacken and Mr. Dibbing to add some comments.
Thank you, Mr. May. Mr. Hacken, welcome.
Thank you.
He's got part of House District 21B, folks. I want you to know that. Thank you for coming today. But please introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Stephen Hacken. I'm county assessor in Winona County. Just a little background from a county assessor's point of view. I've been a county assessor between Pine County and Winona County since 1985. So I've been at a management position since these bills have all been passed. And it certainly has been the understanding of assessors over the years that the 1992 law would exempt concrete berms, those catch basins, and those secondary type of items. The city of Winona has significant amounts of these due to the harbor traffic where it becomes a regional area. Most of that property is owned by a corporation that's around the whole country, CHS. This year, according following the director from Revenue, we exempted $7.4 million worth of these facilities. $3.5 million of it was on one parcel in the city of Winona. It also extended out to some of our townships. CHS has a brand new facility north of St. Charles in a township, pretty much all agricultural, that, you know, significantly over, you know, a couple million dollars. You know, we have some big properties in Winona County on that. And I think from assessor's point of view, I think it tends to be a fairness issue. I have a large malting plant in Winona that every square inch of it's taxable. We have tanks in the same harbor areas as these fertilizer properties that store different products that aren't exempt from the law. They're taxable, but if you store liquid fertilizer in them, the tanks are exempt. We have domes down on the harbor that look like the Martians landed. That the largest one stores 120,000 tons of dry fertilizer that comes right off of barges and into these properties. And it just, you know, it's kind of my, you know, certainly my opinion that if all other storage in the world is going to be taxed, these probably should be as well for an equity issue.
So Mr. Hacken, you said since 1992, it's been understood by really all assessors in the state that the law applied to the catch basin portion. Can you expound on that?
That's certainly how in my career it's been managed, and talking to most of my colleagues, you know, we have exceptions out there that have looked at it a little different, but I think the majority of the assessors, that's been their understanding, that, you know, they have not been exempting, you know, tanks and, you know different types of structures. And you know, I think from our point, you know, if you want to exempt those, I'm fine. I think it's these expensive buildings that we have concerns over.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Dibbing, welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Tom Dibbing. I'm Houston County Assessor. I'm also the chair of the Ag Committee for the state of Minnesota for the Assessors Association. And Mr. Wold that spoke and gave a little bit of history of farming did a very good job of it. In the beginning, you know, prior to in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, it was all about dry fertilizer. And when dry fertilizer fell on the ground, it was easy to pick up. When farmers got bigger and as they used liquid fertilizers, if there was a spill or a contamination issue, it was really hard to do. So when you look at the definition of catch basins, a basin is a liquid vessel that, you know, contains that stuff. So we definitely looked at it since 1992 as a secondary containment issue if there was a spill that went on a property. And I think everybody spoke well on how we looked at it since that time period.
Thank you, Mr. Dibbing. Members, questions for any of these folks. Thank you all for coming, and if we have questions, I'm sure the assessor team will be at ready. Thank you. Mr. Bond, Mr. Marr, and Mr. Barchender, and Mr. Murray. I hope I didn't butcher your names too much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For members of the committee, my
Welcome,
name is Bill Bond. I represent the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. It's a trade association representing what in agriculture we call the ag dealers, who work either in small independent agribusinesses throughout Minnesota's agricultural areas or in cooperatives. And they tend to be the agronomy portion of a co-op. And just a brief introduction in terms of agriculture. I was raised on a dairy farm, and my dad milked cows by hand and had a one-pegged stool, and things have changed dramatically across the landscape in that time frame.
Do you still have the stool, Mr. Bond?
I do not. I certainly wish I did.
Would want that today.
Yes, they would. And the reason that we're here is because we also want to work with the author, and he's graciously offer to work with us on this bill, because it is a bill that addresses a serious issue, but the issue needs to be understood not only from the local government point of view, and I was also a county commissioner in Dodge County, so I do understand an issue that this issue of property tax in Minnesota is extremely complex, as only people in local government can understand it. An assessment is done by one unit of government, and mill rates and tax rates and budgets are set by multiple units of government and special taxing districts, and that's what you try and administer. I hats off to you. What we are suggesting here is that you also need to understand this from the perspective of the agricultural agribusiness, and in that regard, we say we have observed the bill and law has been in effect since 1992. It has been inconsistently or not at all enforced in some areas of the state. So we're actually talking about repealing something that has been in place since 1992. There are 99 exemptions in state law. I dare say, if you started repealing those exemptions, if you read them, you would have people descending on this capital by the thousands. So it's a very serious thing to repeal an exemption, I suggest. That said, we are supportive of working to compromise and do something that would tighter define this bill, because it has broadened beyond, we think, the original intent. So we aren't supporting the bill as it's currently stated, but we certainly are supporting a compromise. With that, I'm going to introduce the chairman of our board, Craig Maurer. Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Bond. Mr. Maurer.
Mr. Chair, I'm Craig Maurer. I'm chairman of the Minnesota Crop Retailers for the state of Minnesota. I'm also a retailer in southeast Minnesota for Central Farm Service.
From House District 21B, Mr. Maurer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very close. In our area, and truly the ag industry is moving to newer and larger facilities. I mean, these facilities built in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that were reconformed, redid to meet the mandate laws for 1992 are past, pretty well past us, okay? We've moved ahead building facilities, some of them ranging anywhere from 7 to 8 million up to 40, 50 million, okay? Most of these facilities are diked completely. We dike these not only for the safety and our footprint on the ground as far as environment and water safety, but we have mandates from the fire marshal to put sprinkler systems in these facilities if there's fire, and consequently our liability is huge if this product runs off these facilities. So we've diked all of these facilities in the new ones that are being built today. We closed 5 facilities and put them into one. And in our area, in the past 10 years, there has been 4 more built relatively the same. We didn't build them for a tax exemption. We built them for our growers to serve our farmers better. And any kind of exemption that we take will go directly to the grower. We have to do business. We have to make money for the grower. And those are issues that we have. Our facility there, we've heard about people paying or losing money to taxes. We are paying more taxes. we're paying taxes of $90,000 on a 30-acre property that only provided $1,200 taxes to Holden Township 3 years ago. With the exemption on top of that, it's going to be another $30,000 to $40,000 on top of that. So we are paying more taxes than we did, and we're paying taxes on the existing properties that we have closed and we have to do environmental cleanup on, and that'll probably range from anywhere to $200,000 to $300,000 or up to $500,000 on a facility by the time we do the environmental cleanup. So the industry is moving ahead to do our job better, protect water, provide services to our customers and our growers and our farmers and our ag industry in the state of Minnesota. Otherwise, I guess it's hard to say that someone here is telling you we're paying more taxes. So that's quite an interest. Everybody's less. So anyway, Paul, would you like to?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Maurer. Mr. Barkin?
I'll help you.
Thank you.
I am Paul Bartschinger. I'm the Agronomy Division Manager for Hutchinson Co-op in Hutchinson, Minnesota, which is in McLeod County, and as far as I know.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good house district, too, I understand. There's 134 of them.
Really, this bill was designed years ago to not only encourage environmental concerns. The ag retail industry is very mindful of environmental concerns and groundwater in particular. Diking and containment areas were constructed over the years to reduce and or eliminate groundwater contamination. The dikes and secondary containment facilities we built, specific to the MDA specifications, and in most cases added several hundred thousand dollars to the cost of our facilities. The diking, curbing, etc., serve real no financial value to the business. Just because we've got a curb and a dike and a containment area around some tanks does not make us any more money. In most cases, there's maintenance involved in those kind of things that we wouldn't have to do if it wasn't there. In some cases, there are hindrance, driving over curbs and those kind of things that we talked about here earlier. The ag retail industry has done what was required and mandated by the MDA since 1992. We've done our part. We've played by the rules. It's just been an oversight by local officials, namely assessors, since 1992 that has caused the exemption to be overlooked. And that's really the issue at point here. I guess I would like to just sum up this portion of my presentation. Is the bottom line is the exemption has not been given. I built a new facility in Arlington, Minnesota, which again is in Sibley County. It was constructed, completed last fall in 2015 within the city of Arlington. I was involved with some conversations with the city of Winthrop with their situation over there. In the situation with Winthrop, the taxes have been collected erroneously. The city of Arlington has not got any additional taxes out of me, out of the co-op, because the facility is new. So they're not missing what they haven't gotten, if you understand what I'm saying. They are on board. They know that the exemption exists and it is there. Just a couple other points. Most cooperatives are farmer-owned and they're small businesses. They're rural communities and are sometimes the largest employers in town, and that was mentioned before. Ag retailers, ag supply co-ops, they're in business to serve customers. We're not in business to generate huge profits for the company, to be quite honest with you. This isn't corporate America. If we put 2 to 3% on the bottom line at the end of the year, we feel like we had a good year. If that was another corporation, we probably would have been shut down years ago. The loss of the property tax exemption would have a negative impact on the ability to achieve accepted profitable levels and could lead to layoffs and et cetera and those kind of things. With thank that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Barkinder. I think you encapsulated kind of part of the crux of what we have here is because things have been enforced differently in different locales, and then we'll hear from Mr. Cummings when he comes up, but because of that, and then the Department of Revenue suddenly saying we need everybody to enforce them similarly, that's what brings us here today, and that's kind of the crux of the issue for us to understand. Thank you. Mr. Murray.
Yes,
And Mr. Chairman, if I might
Mr. Bond.
Just mention that Bob Zelenka from Minnesota Grain and Feed could not be here today, and he said that he would let us speak for him on his behalf, and I wanted to make sure that was the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bond. Mr. Murray.
Did you want to refer to these?
Welcome. Oh, and the photos are coming around. Do we have some additional ones, Mr. Maurer?
No, we don't. Are there any questions about these photos?
Questions that members have. As you see in the photos, they're kind of self-explanatory. They're over here. I think they have come around.
I'll be around afterwards.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Maurer.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Murray, and I see Mr. Clavin, too. Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Patrick Murray. I'm with Cooperative Network. Thank you for allowing me to testify today in opposition to House File 2936. We do appreciate the dialogue that we've had with Representative Backer, as well as you, Chairman Drazkowski, so far on this legislation. Cooperative Network is a two-state trade group of not-for-profit, member-owned cooperatives of various kinds in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Minnesota is the number one cooperative state in the nation, with more than 1,000 cooperative businesses headquartered here. These cooperative businesses, in turn, are owned by more than 3.4 million residents in the state. Our broad membership includes a number of local Minnesota cooperatives that would be negatively impacted by the proposed property tax exemption repeal contained in House File 2936. As folks have heard already, in 1992, this tax exemption was authorized for structures that contain certain crop inputs. These containment structures were mandated by state law. Since 1992, this exemption has been applied in a variety of ways by local assessors. This includes some assessors who are not applying the exemption at all. We've talked about this already. As folks also know, last year there was an effort made in the Senate to repeal the exemption. It was Senate File 257, which is in the conference committee right now. We opposed this proposal last year. We continue to propose this provision, which would again repeal this tax exemption for ag containment facilities, an exemption we might note never even realized by some due to improper and or inconsistent application. This legislation would have significant financial impact on local member-owned cooperatives. We heard that testimony from several of our colleague organizations already. Cooperatives are not-for-profit entities and operate as close as prudently possible to a zero net margin. Co-ops return their net revenues in a different setting. These would be profits back to their member owners in the form of payments proportional to their patronage of their cooperative. Much of that patronage paid finds its way back into the local economy, fueling the kind of consumer spending and reinvestment that's so badly needed in greater Minnesota. Again, Cooperative Network has met with the author of the bill, Representative Backer. We've met with you, Chairman Drazkowski. We appreciate the dialogue, and we think that there is some type of resolution that we can come with on this legislation going forward. And again, members, I would like to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. Clavin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I also work with Cooperative Network. I'm not on the list, and I hadn't planned to speak, but after listening, there's 2 points here I think need to be made for the benefit of the members. No one, not one person yet this morning, has told you what the operative language of this is. You look at your bill, you'll see this is Subdivision 23 is repealed.
Yep.
If you look at Subdivision 23 and read it, it talks about the tanks, basins, and that portion of the structure. Now, we've heard a little bit about, well, we only thought it was the catch basin. It's the structure, the tank. For this facility to confine the chemicals as defined in 18DO1, that's an ag section, as required by the Commissioner of Agriculture. It's a mandate.
Yeah.
This language passed in 1992, and I went upstairs and looked, the session law in 1992, that's passed verbatim 24 years ago. It's an unfunded mandate on the co-ops and the businesses that have to put these tanks in. Now, it might be a good idea environmentally, but that hasn't been discussed here today. No one's read you that language that these things are required by the Commissioner of Ag, and you've heard EPA. EPA is carried out locally through PCA and Ag, depending upon the issue. So it's an unfunded government mandate on our members, and I wanted to point that out. Mr. Gary Carlson talked about the $112 million. I'm not going to dispute the figure about the $112 million, but we could argue that that's $112 million we wouldn't have spent on this stuff other than the fact that we had to. So I think that can be a little bit in dispute. I would also point out that in 1992, there is no way this was passed as some sort of incentive for the co-ops to build stuff, as Mr. Wold suggested earlier. The industry certainly changed, and there's no doubt about that. But I don't think you can construe a government mandate as some sort of incentive, as has been suggested here. And finally, on the issue of the shift, and this comes from Mr. Carlson Keith, he's right about this land value discussion going back to 08. If you look at farm property being maybe $1,000 an acre back then, and it's now five, it's gone way, way up, no question. We would see that as sort of a windfall to the counties. As the land values have gone up, the farmers have paid more and more. And you had testimony from Clay County. Some Representative Marquardt's constituents were near. They were in here on a school bond question, but they also pointed out how much more they're paying. And now we're starting to hear from the counties that we're going to lose tax base as the values drop. We would see that as a huge windfall that the counties have had. They hadn't dropped the homeowner property taxes when they got more from ag. And now that ag is starting to lose, they're concerned about their tax base. I just want to point that out, that that has been a huge, huge increase that our members have paid counties. So that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin. So, Mr. Clavin, does anyone know? I assume that this was kind of, the exemption was written at that time to say, okay, government, we're mandating this to you, and in return to relieve some of the pressure of the mandate, we're going to give you an exemption on the property tax for it. Were those hand in glove at the time, Mr. Clavin?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer specifically. My first session was 95, so I've been here 22 years, and this was 3 years prior. It's never been an issue. I don't have any institutional memory of 92. I would guess, though, at the time it was as a way to compensate for that. I would see it more as a, we're forcing you to put this in, so we're not going to tax it, versus we'll give you a tax break as an incentive to put some sort of tank in or catch basin.
Thank you. Representative Quam and then Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If staff could enlighten us, are there any other exemptions or tax code that basically says, since we're forcing you to build something for the good of the state, the community, we are exempting it from property taxes by not having it valued? You understand where I'm going?
Good question.
I'm just trying to understand if this is unique or if it's been utilized before.
Mr. Hines? Do we see it elsewhere in statute where there's a mandate from government and accompanying that mandate is a property tax exemption?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Quam, nothing similar to that immediately comes to mind, although there might be others in the room who might be able to come up with something. I mean, there is a pollution control exemption for some types of business properties that might fit into that category, that and some utility, there's a sliding scale exemption for some kind of parts of utility property. So there may be some other kinds of things that come to mind that might sort of fit that category, but nothing large scale that comes immediately to mind.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be nice to find out if we have other things sitting out there in statute that are not being universally implemented, just so that we can be proactive in discovering these and address them more timely.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps this is for Mr. Hines, too. But, you know, the tradition of putting something in session law and not codifying it, sometimes I think, maybe not sometimes, usually suggests it's temporary, because session law is session law. And since we don't codify it, I'm questioning why this has never been examined since 1992. Mr. Hines, am I way off on this?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, just to be clear, this is codified.
Oh, it is.
This is a codified section of
I'm
statute.
Sorry.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
Mr. Clavin,
when I reference the session law, that's the book it's in. Upstairs in the library, you'll go
okay,
see.
Okay, but then
session
it was
law
codified.
From 1992
okay,
is where you can
I'm
pull
sorry.
It out. It's just a research phrase, but it is codified for sure.
Thank you.
Gotcha. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If staff ends up looking at Representative Quam's question, it seems to me it makes sense to look at the opposite as well, which is, are there mandates that do not exempt property taxpayers from from paying taxes. And I'm even thinking about, you know, there's all kinds of mandates about at various levels about how buildings need to be constructed, about, you know, zoning for houses, there's various things. I'm just sort of thinking the opposite question from Representative Quams about other examples of mandates that don't exempt somebody from property taxes, and I suspect we find a lot like that. Thank you.
I'm wondering how big Representative Backer wants his bill to be, given we have a few weeks left. But
35 pages.
But good points, both Representative Pinto and Representative Quam. Other questions, members? Representative Anderson.
For Mr. Chairman, to pick up on what Representative Pinto mentioned, I think we're going down that road with the buffer law, that we're going to be mandating land out of production with so far no compensation and no tax changes. So I think we're going down that road anyway.
Good point. Other questions, members? Okay, Representative Erickson. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for House research, when they have some downtime after we leave and you have all your homework done, Mr. Hines, are these 99 exemptions listed in the tax incident study?
Mr. Hines. Could you repeat that, Representative Erickson?
The 99 exemptions to which we've had testifiers referring, are they in the tax incident study?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, they're in some of them, most of them are covered in the tax expenditure study.
Oh, okay,
in
expenditure.
At least in broad categories, and to the extent possible, they try to capture that in the tax expenditure study, but not the tax incident study.
So, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
And Mr. Hines, are they easily discovered if we're studying the expenditures or the incidents side? What I'm thinking about is categorizing, perhaps as a project, when you have downtime, which I know you don't have much of, so that we could see what has happened over the years to the farming community, the ag community, and then also contrast that with what the EPA or the Department of Agriculture at the federal level has mandated. Because I don't think we have a clear understanding of what's happened over the decades to bring some of these, maybe some of this confusion or contradiction about. And I have just found that if you can see this delineated, all of these exemptions, and then what's mandated by us, what's mandated by the feds, that we have a clear understanding of what we can do to change policy or to perhaps relieve our taxpayers.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, we will put that on our list, but I would say that the one thing that could come be a valuable resource here is that every 6 years the department collects information on all exempt property in the state, and it just so happens that 2016 is one of those years. So within the next, I'm not sure exactly if it'll come out in 2016 or even in 2017, but sometime before long we'll get an updated listing of the amount of value that's exempt in most of the major categories that would help us understand some of those questions. And I think to the extent that we can then add some information about where those exemptions came from into a report, that there will be further information available.
That's excellent. Thank you.
Thank you both. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification, and when we're talking about, I think, and maybe staff could correct me if I'm wrong, that the assessed valuation changing on farmland has not been a windfall for counties, because basically when we look at the assessed valuation, all we're doing is dividing up the proportional share of the levy.
Sure.
So the levy is set by the local governments, and then they use the assessment method for divvying up who pays what. So as we move through this, I think being able to relate it and maybe actual dollars that are affected here as well, because when you look at the change in the net tax capacity, I'm not sure how this property is being treated relative to farmland or maybe Main Street businesses and so forth. So I know that might tend to complicate the discussion even more, but I do think that it adds some relevance, because when I look at in Winthrop or Walnut Grove or whatever, at a 1.74 or 1,746,500, and the tax capacity going down by 13.55%, I mean, those are the real dollars, and basically all this is doing is shifting those dollars to some other taxpayer. Now the farmland happened to be the disproportionate share of picking up a lot of that because of the increase in property values. But that's going to change over time, too, as property, as the farmland prices go down and the Main Street businesses go up, or maybe the residences go up. So I think if we're going to do this, we have to look at the total picture and what the real impact is on people's bottom line.
Thank you. Maybe Mr. Carlson will come back next week with a few more columns on his sheet. Is he here? If that was a request I kind of heard inherently. Other question, Mr. Clavin.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you for that comment. Maybe a better word to use than windfall on my part would be disproportionate, because outside of the buffer law, the property tax issue is the most I've heard at farm meetings in the past year or two. So maybe that's a better word than windfall. It would be disproportionate.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin. Other questions, members? Thank you both. Next we will have Mr. Cummings. Good morning, Mr. Cummings. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. So I was able to email Representative Backer. We thank him for working on this bill. The bill addresses concerns that have been raised about the taxation of ag chemical containment facilities since 2013. Some have noticed that there had been unequal application of the law around the state. Some had raised questions that exempting these facilities would shift a high amount of property taxes onto homeowners and other businesses. To those points, we thank the committee for spending time discussing these issues today. As previously mentioned, in 1992, the legislature passed an exemption for agricultural chemical containment facilities effective for 1993. It's believed that this exemption was in reaction to the MPCA and the Department of Agriculture issuing new standards regarding the construction, maintenance, use, and ultimate disposal of structures used for agricultural chemicals. The exemption is prescriptive in nature, with three major items being mentioned: containment tanks, catch basins, and that portion of the structure needed for the containment facility used to confine agricultural chemicals. Over the years, the intent of the legislation has been sort of lost, and a clear understanding of what these three items encompassed to assessors does not exist. Recently, the counties, in response to a question from one of their own members, realized that there was an inconsistency, and we had been a question had been asked to the department to provide some guidance and direction. The Department of Revenue issued guidance to state that according to the law, agricultural chemical containment facilities are exempt. The feedback we heard that many were concerned that this would remove property from the tax rolls that were currently being taxed, and in some cases cause a substantial tax shift in small jurisdictions. I know we heard that from some today. Part of the issue stems from the fact that storage practices have changed dramatically since 1992. Well, the law has remained the same. In 1992, most agricultural chemicals were wet chemicals, and their storage facilities were suited for those types of chemicals. As dry fertilizer storage buildings or structures have become ubiquitous and larger, really these super storage facilities, rather than very small sites, were not treated the same as the wet containment facilities. In addition, we see a difference in how people are applying the exemption. Some assessors are only exempting a secondary wall and containment tanks. Mr. Chair, in learning about this issue and preparing for possible legislation, we really did work to try and distinguish between those components necessary for containment and those structural elements that were not necessary for containment. We sat down with the Department of Agriculture, and we found out that this was a difficult venture. Sometimes for wet containment, you're seeing that these secondary containment elements were something that we had seen and was needed. But as they were presenting designs, they were noticing that some of the primary containment was the same as secondary containment, whereas dry chemicals would abut up against a wall, and that was the containment necessary that would make it go against. Sometimes with the wet containment facilities, there were other types of containments around containments. And I know that, so we really tried to look at that distinction and found it very difficult, and know that that distinction is difficult, different for wet and dry. Also, we sort of asked, well, what are those parts of the sort of these dry superstructures, dry chemical superstructures, that are needed in order to meet some of the specifications under the law, according to the Department of Agriculture? And they said, well, you know, you need a roof. We tell them that they need a roof on their structure. We tell them that they need walls on their structures. And the Department of Agriculture basically said, you know, I guess they don't need a bathroom in the location, you know, and maybe that could be something that could, that is a difference. When we were sort of thinking about possible ways in order to split this or change it, I mean, we were going through the same exercise that this committee was too. We found that difficult to do. In addition, when we were thinking, well, should these remain exempt and should these not remain exempt, we were trying to think of what are other things that the state may put regulations on that are in fact taxable. So even a home is something that has to be developed to certain codes. You know, there may be a wheelchair ramp. We have the there are land use facilities on various agricultural land, or even land that is used for conservation. We have even the nuclear dry casks. You know, that is some hazardous containment that is needed, and those, you know, are taxable. So I think we understand the discussion. I think we understand the pressure points from both the co-op facilities as well as the local communities. And I think one of the things that we want to ensure happens is this moves from right now until the end is that we provide clarity. And we believe that this bill provides that clarity for taxpayers. It provides that clarity for also tax administrators. And we thank Representative Backer for bringing this bill forward. As this bill moves forward, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Representative Backer, and staff. Thank you for the opportunity for being a resource. And we'll take questions, and we have other resources we can provide from the department to come down as well.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, what do they do in other largely ag states like Iowa and North Dakota? Would you provide us with that contrast sometime, or that comparison?
Mr. Cummins.
Because they would be, I'm from the River Valley of the North Dakota, so, you know, I've seen a lot of these structures grew up from those archaic days that were noted in an earlier testimony to today. So it would be good to know, what are our neighboring states doing so that we also may study that?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, and I don't know that offhand, so I really do appreciate Representative Erickson giving us the opportunity to respond. Maybe there is some way in which we know what all 50 states are doing, and maybe it is just doing a survey of our neighboring states. But we'll get back to the committee with that information.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
I didn't think I was this close in line. But anyway, a couple questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To clear up some confusion, if a co-op builds a 30,000-ton fertilizer plant, there's a lot of extras, there are blending towers, things like that. Under your ruling, is the entire facility to be tax-exempt, or just the roof, the walls, the cement? Please clarify that.
Mr. Cummings.
I'm going to, just to ensure that I'm giving the correct answer, I'm going to ask Mr. Klockstein to come down. I believe it's the entire facility, but I would want to make sure. So,
Mr. Klockstein, welcome.
Thank you. My name is John Klockstein. I'm the assistant director over in the property tax division. Mr. Chair, representative, our directive to assessors is to exempt those items that are necessary to containment. So, for example, if a blending tower serves a function that is not necessary to containment, then that would be taxable.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. So
again, to Mr. Cummins, just to clarify, the department put out this directive exempting these facilities, and now you're saying you support the Backer bill. I just want to get that correct.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, the department, I think that what the department would like to see in the end is clarity, so that everyone across the state has a clear understanding of how to apply the law, both taxpayers and tax administrators. We think that the Backer bill would achieve that. So we're not, I don't think that we're trying to take a position in terms of who should pay more tax, but we are trying to take a position to say we think that both taxpayers and tax administrators want clarity. Now, others today provided other opinions, right, in terms of who should pay the tax and how that should work. We're trying to ensure that there's clarity in terms of how this moves forward.
Representative Anderson. Thank you. Mr. Clarkson, so could you state that again? You mentioned something about, you know, the parts necessary to contain. So does that include the roof and the walls, or are we talking about the cement curb and dikes? Can you elaborate?
Mr. Chair, there's several reasons that you would build a roof over a structure. If one of those reasons are for containment function, then that roof could be exempted under the current law.
So would there be any situation where a co-op or other egg facility wouldn't suggest or communicate that roof was for containment? I mean, wouldn't that be 100% of the facilities probably, or close to it?
Mr. Chair, there are situations that we looked into where there was storage in bulk tanks within a structure, and the curb was necessary should that bulk tank rupture. However, because the tank within the building was self-contained, perhaps in that situation, maybe the roof was not necessary.
Thank you. So, gentlemen, and Mr. Cummings, you mentioned three categories: catch basin, storage tanks, and what was the third one again? Maybe Mr. Clarkson knows.
Containment tanks, catch basins, and the portion of the structure needed for the containment facility to confine agricultural chemicals.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Quam, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, in order for clarity, we've been hearing back and forth whether it was incentive, whether it was in compensation. To be clear, does it matter if it's the law is made for incentive or the law is made for compensation? If it's an exemption, are they enforced equally within the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, we're applying the law, so we're not. I don't know what the difference would be in terms of why legislative intent would be helpful in trying to figure that. We're trying to figure out what the law says and how that would apply to the various assessment across the state.
Representative Quam,
sure that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The point was, you know, we spent a lot of time debating why. That's irrelevant. It's the law. And, you know, the reason doesn't matter whether you're going to enforce or not. Then the final question is, do county assessors have discretion in following, you know, law or statute? I'm trying to understand why somebody would be ignore.
Mr. Cummings, so why do we have the situation we have that the department reacted to in the last few years? I think that's what Representative Quam is saying. Mr. Clarkson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we responded to a question we received from an assessor on how to administrate this exemption, and so that we were clarifying that. And when we find consistencies, it's our job, the commissioner is charged with being the overseer of the property tax system, to direct assessors to be uniform in their application of the property tax laws, and so that's what we did.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The point I get out of this is that apparently there is a lack of training, and that, you know, frankly, if it's the law, you enforce it. If it's a law that's not good, you do what representatives do, bring a bill forward to try and fix it. And it'd be nice to understand how the we fell through the cracks when it came to the people that are doing this assessment. And because I've had a lot of farmers come forward and not understand why there are, you know, some of these assessment decisions made. And I think at some point it'd be really nice to understand what training, you know, certification, all these processes to try and ensure that people doing the assessment on these properties are up to date, do continuing education to keep up to date, and are consistent across the state. Because, you know, frankly, I'm shocked the decades of inappropriate applying of the law.
Thank you, Representative Quam, and members. Representative Quam brings up the point that it's not the law that's the issue here; it's the difference in application that has brought this issue forward. And so, Mr. Cummings, do you have any comments to Representative Quam's question?
Mr. Chair and members, I would only highlight that I know that the legislature has talked about this issue, this very issue, in the past. They have asked the department to work with assessors across the state. I know that there were some new standards in terms of assessor accreditation. We're working very, very hard in order to meet that timeline, Mr. Chair, in terms of trying to ensure that we have that we're meeting the standards so that we have a consistency across the state as much as possible. The assessors, we have a very complex property tax code, and I know our assessors are doing all that they can in order to comply with that. We continue to want to be partners with them in trying to do what we can to help them with that.
Mr. Croxy, Mr. Cummings, do we know how many counties up to this point have been enforcing the law accurately, and how many have not?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to read from the memo that that was drafted. We have identified 55 counties, 254 cities and towns, and 142 school districts that will lose tax base. So I think that the 50, you know, obviously we did not hear back from every county, and we don't know if there are facilities in every county, but there are 55 counties in which there would be a change in the tax base due to the change due to the guidance that was provided.
So 55 out of the 87 counties have not been enforcing the law accurately, is what I'm hearing. Is that correct, Mr. Croxy?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's important to remember that assessors were administering the law under their best understanding, and they asked us for clarification. And when you look at the law, you could you know, there could be some ambiguity there, and so we did take a look at it and we provided that clarification. When there is a clarification and it requires the assessor to change, that doesn't mean that he wasn't administering it under the law as he saw prior to that.
Mr. Croxy, I'm confused. So if
Mr. Chair,
can you elaborate?
Yeah, sure, certainly. Mr. Chair, as we heard today, that the law has not changed since 1992, and yet farming practices have changed dramatically since that time. And I think that is where we see, as assessors testified, that they always understood the law in a particular way. And when we, as Paul Cummings said, the property tax system is very complex, and we cannot examine every piece of the law every year, and so when we don't receive questions, we assume that it's being administered correctly.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to comment that perhaps besides the
the uniformity of the application that the Department of Revenue's greatest interest in this is the general levy, which also means that the exemption doesn't just change county's interest in revenue or the school district or local government, but will also impact these businesses with regard to the state general levy. So, you know, this is the frustrating thing about our property tax system, and we've got about 80 people in here who spent now 125 hours jawing about this. It's just a frustrating part of our system.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. I'm wondering if staff I didn't see it in the fiscal information, so if we remove the exemption, does that affect the general levy?
Yeah.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, it would not affect the amount the state would collect through the general levy. It would, to the extent that more tax base would become exempt under this, under the bill, that would cause the state general levy rate to have to go up, and it would change how the levy was collected, but it would not affect collections to the state general fund.
So the state would extract the same amount, but differently?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Members, other questions? Mr. Cummings, Mr. Kleinstein. I'll get it. Representative Pinto.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify. I think, would it be the opposite to Mr. Hines, that because the bill would exempt less property, the rate would actually go down? It seemed like it was the opposite of what Mr. Hines said, but I'm sure I understood. Since there'd be less property, would be exempt.
I'm thinking you might be right, but Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, let's see. Under the bill, some property that's now being taxed would... excuse me, you're correct. More property would become taxable, the rate would go down.
Yes. Good catch, Mr. Representative Pinto. Okay, thank you, Mr. Cloxing, Mr. Cummings, thank you so much. So at this point, Representative Backer, any final comments? We need to get
moving. Yeah, we need to get away. See, thank you, Chair and members, for this. You know, my summary would be, I think Representative Vogel summarized it well. You know, we have a property tax. When ag land goes up, homeowners don't have to pay as much, but it is, you know, it goes up and down depending on the valuation, what's exempt and what's not exempt. We're just looking for a fair system instead of the people on fixed income being redistribute that share of property tax. And I think we'll come up with something here.
Thank you. So, well, Representative Backer, you're going to go back into the workshop and we'll and meet with some of these folks, and we'll come back in another week or so and have another discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I like the cost of fertilizers going up.
Okay, next, members on the agenda, we have House File 3403, Representative Lewick. Representative Lewick, welcome. At this point, the chair moves House File 3403 to be laid over. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3403 attempts to resolve an anomaly we have when an item such as a pipeline or a large utility power line that would run across a number of counties. For example, pipelines may run across the entire state of Minnesota. Those are appraised. Their market value is established by the Department of Revenue, and that certainly makes sense. We don't need 87 counties individually attempting to establish the market value of their small piece of that pipeline or other utility. But what does occur that has a huge impact on local units of government is when a utility contests that market value, then if the Department of Revenue and the utility can't resolve that, it goes to tax court. In tax court, after sometimes a number of years, the the tax court will find, sometimes in favor of the utility. What happens to the local units of government when that occurs is that market value may be reduced. That may have happened 5-6 years ago. Starting at that point, oftentimes 6 years ago, that changes the property tax statement of that utility in that county, that school district, that city, that township, and those counties and small units of government are typically liable to write that check within 30 days of that court order. For counties, they tend to run with at least 50% of their operating expenses in reserve. That's sort of, at least I believe that's the state auditor's general recommended level. In the case of townships, smaller cities, and other taxing districts, they may not have that kind of reserve, but they have no choice but to write that check. And that's not just a single year's worth. That goes back however many years when the first issue with that market value was incorrect. So easily you could have 5 years of misinterpretation. Well, just basically 5 years of tax statements that have to be redone, and those units of governments have to pay right on the spot or they're in contempt of court. What 3503 would do would simply put the responsibility to make the plaintiff, a tax court, whole, put that responsibility with the state of Minnesota in a general fund. We are talking about a number of taxes. We're talking about all those local property taxes, and we're talking about the general business tax that are impacted when this occurs. I've got a number of testifiers here. Hopefully they'll be brief. I know you've been very patient with a lengthy discussion on another element of property taxes. This is just it's an effort to correct this and to take this anomaly off the backs of the local units of government, because when you got to write a check like that tax shift has to be made up down the way, so you see levies go up hugely to make up for that, because when that occurs, it can be pretty devastating. So any questions for me? But certainly there's more brighter bulbs in the room on property tax here, and they would certainly be willing to testify in a little more detail on this.
I think we don't see the rest of the bulbs. Mr. Fox, Mr. Hilgert, Mr. Sulem, let your light shine upon us. Mr. Hilgert, would you want to kick it off?
Sure.
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Matt Hilgert. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. I'm also here, speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Inter-County Association, as well as the Minnesota Association of Townships. AMC is supportive of Representative Lewick's bill, and we appreciate him authoring this. One of the primary reasons for our association's support is based on the continuing occurrence and frequency of these utility tax court cases and the resulting refunds and impacts on local communities, which Representative Lewick just explained. In the state of Minnesota, the Department of Revenue assesses utility properties. This includes electric companies, gas distribution companies, pipelines, and cooperatives. These properties and assessments are very complex, and counties are grateful for the DOR's expertise. Counties are not saying they are the right party to assess the very technical and cross-jurisdictional properties. The Department of Revenue also works in consultation with the Attorney General's office to defend these cases if and when they reach tax court. Likewise, counties would not argue that they have the legal capacity to argue these extremely technical cases, particularly when the state is so well versed in the technicalities of the assessing rules, and occasionally goes as far to compensate expertise witnesses to provide support in these cases. This is all to say that counties are aware that there is a role for the state and respect the intricacies around the assessing rules themselves, as well as the revenue these assessments bring local communities. Where county's concerns come into play is the continued frequency and unpredictability of these cases, which are often multi-year refunds consisting of 2 to 3 years of tax assessments rolled into one case, one ruling, and often resulting in large several-hundred-thousand-dollar issue returns. These refund orders have a direct impact on a county's reserve, their budget, and their taxpayers. For a township, this impact is magnified. We are appreciative of Representative Lewick's bill because it brings several relevant and important questions into play. Primarily, what is the core issue resulting in the perceived increase in financial magnitude of these cases? Secondly, is this issue something that will be resolved with time or not? And thirdly, if not, what can be done to ensure the following? Consistent, clear, and understood assessment rules surrounding the assessment of complex utility properties, continued and enhanced clear communication between the Department of Revenue and local governments, and most importantly, I think, what can be done to lessen the burdens to local governments and taxpayers when these large refunds are ordered after the county has already budgeted, levied, and spent taxpayer funds? AMC remains open and willing to discuss options and ideas with all the partners involved in this, and I do want to say Department of Revenue for the last 2 years has been very helpful in getting us not only data, but also collaborating with local commissioners and leaders. They've held several meetings to kind of discuss at length why these cases are happening and the rules, Rule 8100, which is pretty in-depth and discusses terms like economic obsolescence, which is way over my head, but trying to explain to us why these cases are going to court as frequently as they are. So with that, I would kick it over to Commissioner Bob Fox from Renville County to describe how this can impact a rural county.
Thank you, Mr. Hilger. Welcome, Commissioner Fox.
Thank you, Chairman Drahilski and committee members. Good morning. My name is Bob Fox. I'm a commissioner representing the 2nd District of Renville County. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 3403 and tell you how these situations can affect local government. It was in my second year as commissioner we heard that Alliance Pipeline was disputing their 2004 evaluation payable 2005 taxes. Then it was their 2005 valuation, then 2006. With these 3 years, our county share repayment was over $261,000. For the townships, it was over $32,000. Schools, nearly $75,000. Kingman Township was one of the pumping stations, had a repayment of over $12,000. In rural areas, this could make up 20 to 25% of their annual budget. One of the two school districts had a repayment of over $50,000 for their bill. I know you all have visited with your local school officials, but I will never forget the look on that superintendent's face when we told him he had to repay that bill. It was like asking to cut one teacher. It started again in 2009, valuation payable taxes 2010. Then it was valuations for 2010, 2011, 2012. This time our county share of repayment was over $123,000, townships over $20,000, and schools over $50,500. If you remember, some of these years local governments were under levy limits, the economy had gone south, and local government aid was being cut too. When you add all these factors together, it was difficult to budget, and we were scrutinized for our budgeting as we told our citizens that we had to repay taxes that were set by the Department of Revenue, settlements that were negotiated by the department, but the repayments were billed to local governments through the county. For Kingman Township and the two school districts, we set up a repayment plan for them to the county, and the county repaid the total amount due. Our county had met with the Department of Revenue over our frustration with this process, and we're told that these cases would eventually lessen or decrease. We continue to receive notices like this. Luckily, the last one was dropped by the utility. I would never ask anyone to pay more than their share. But if it's fair, the taxes should be paid. I asked the legislature and the department for ideas. Is this a problem with the rules? Is more clarity needed for assessors and tax court? When these companies come to get permitted, should we sit down and figure out what the valuations will be for the first 10 or 15 years and then come to an agreement so it could be part of the original permit? Thank you, Representative Luke. for this authorship of House File 3403 and particular attention to the burdens these cases cause for local government. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Fox. I like your idea of stipulating with the companies. That's good thinking. Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you asked for other ideas. Let's think about all underground infrastructure. We have inter-city, inter-jurisdictional sewer and water pipe. Some here in the metro operated and controlled by a Metropolitan Council. Are they paying taxes to local governments, the school and cities for infrastructure? It just carries a different product. It's still an underground pipe.
I don't know.
Well, but they aren't. And it's done in the general levy, which makes all of the voters, all of the taxpayers accountable. Perhaps a simple solution to this is if the utility companies are paying taxes on underground pipe that none of us see, it ends up in our monthly utility bills. So maybe it should be tax exempt. Forget about it. Forget about the whole system, the whole process. You levy your money at the county and the city local level, and then the local taxpayer is responsible to approve your levy and agrees with the amount of spending. But as long as it's on someone else, who doesn't even get to vote, by the way, on these issues, is the wrong way to approach this. So maybe it should be exempt. And that would encourage cost-effective energy and other services that our utility, our private utility providers, are providing to us. And the cost of that infrastructure will be reflected in your monthly charge, and not inclusive of property taxes, which are a hidden tax, because that's how it comes through on your bill. It's a hidden tax. It's not a line item.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Questions or comments, members? We do have two more bills. We've got Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Hilgert. Mr. Cummings, 1 minute?
Be brief.
30 seconds. Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Lewick. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. This proposal makes the state responsible for issuing refunds of overpayment of taxes that were paid to counties. Because the state general fund does not receive these payments, issuing payments from the general fund for refunds of overpayment seems misplaced. We understand the counties budgeted for a set amount, and any deviation in terms of lost tax base means that part of what they budgeted for is not available. Many counties build into their levies an amount for uncollectible property taxes, for issuing abatement, and for potential refunds due to litigation. The state has experienced a similar phenomenon as well. When local government officials abate property taxes for property that counties assess, they also abate the state general levy, leaving a hole in the state budget and an amount of tax base that we are not able to collect. The same is true when county settles or have values reduced by litigation. Please note, we do have a proposal in our policy bill that ensures that counties are able to know about litigation, share information, and discuss critical elements related to cases on state-assessed property. Mr. Chair, we work in partnership with counties to assess many complex properties. In some cases, those state-assessed values must be used in assessment. In other cases, the values from the state are recommended, not mandatory. We work with counties because these types of properties that are less common in each individual county, but are more common across the state as a whole, and many times they cross multiple counties. The state can be an expert resource for counties who may not have the expertise in an efficient way for the whole state. The committee in previous years had heard the frustrations of counties and assessors who were struggling to assess large and complex properties and were finding that the practices were inconsistent across the state. This committee asked for greater assistance in assessing large and complex properties. The department is working towards assessing based on market values rather than less formal agreements on values, a practice that was common not too far in the past. If this committee believes that we should revert back to each county assessing large and complex properties by themselves, we're open to that discussion, Mr. Chair, but we would advise against it based on the challenges we have previously discussed. Please note that the determination of the court may be to increase, keep the same, or decrease the total value in Minnesota, which is then apportioned to all the operating property in Minnesota for that company. This bill does not address what happens if the court increases a value. Where do those additional payments go? Additionally, this bill is not clear whether the department will need to issue refunds in cases that are settled in the course of litigation. This could change the department and the county's litigation strategies and settlement considerations. There's also a question of how this proposal will be paid for. We see there is some appropriation provisions, but an appropriation in the amount of the refund to DOR is required, but does not create a budget reserve to cover this appropriation as most counties have done. When the state settles large cases dealing with some state taxes, we have an ability to structure the settlement over a number of years to even out the impact on the state budget to ensure that there's some balance. The counties may want to consider an approach of having the authority to enter into long-term structured settlements. We can work with the counties on this approach if requested. If this bill moves through the process, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Representative Lewick, and staff.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Representative Lewick. Representative Lewick, we have two bills yet. Quickly.
If you would indulge me and Mr. Cummings, if you would just sit still for a second here. I'm very curious about how often the tax courts have found against the plaintiff, and we've had to actually go back and actually collect more property taxes on these utilities. Has that occurred in the past, and how many times?
Mr. Cummings, very quickly.
Mr. Chair, in the last 10 years, there's one instance in which the tax court has found against the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Representative Lewick.
And approximately how many times has it went the other way where the tax court is found in favor of the plaintiff and we've had to go back and claw back these taxes?
Mr. Cummings.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misheard the question. There's one time in which the tax court has found against the Department of Revenue in the last 10 years. I don't know about the other instances, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lewick.
So we don't have an answer on how many times you've actually been found against you?
Mr. Chair, the tax court has found
against
the department once in the last 10 years.
Okay.
In terms of the times the Department of Revenue has won, we can get back to the committee on that.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Lewick, thank you. With that, the chair lays over House File 3403. Representative Petersburg. Representative Kosnick moves House File 2719 to be laid over. Representative Petersburg, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe there's an amendment there to just clarify the language as well.
Okay, members, the A1 amendment is before you. Representative Erickson moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. A1 is adopted. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. This is a simple bill. It's a simple request. It's a request that's been given many times, and I hope you rule favorably in it. Basically, it is about an electric plant that's being built in Owatonna and wishing to have some of the property taxes or payment in lieu of taxes forgiven for those or exempt. So that they can save dollars to the local tech utility users and ratepayers. And with that, I do have a testifier who has a written testimony, is here for questions, but I, in brevity, we will just leave it at that, and if you have any other questions, we'll be glad to move forward.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Mr. Shoner?
Mr. Shaner.
Shaner?
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah.
Please
Thank
introduce
you very
yourself.
Much, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Again, I've provided written testimony in the interest of time, since I know you have another bill to do. I will leave that one to you unless you prefer that I read the testimony. Otherwise, I'm here available to answer questions.
Thank you so much for your brevity. Quickly introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Chris Shaner. I'm the Director of Agency and Government Relations for Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, or SMPA. We're the ones that are building the plant in Owatonna.
Thank you. Members, Mr. Shaner's testimony is included in your packet, as are two different resolutions from local units of government in this particular matter. Thank you both. With that, the chair does lay over House File 2719.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. we'll still have a discussion. Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry. I just haven't had enough coffee this morning to keep up with this frantic end of pace. Just a real quick question. Is there anything in there that would guarantee that tax savings would be passed on to consumers?
Yes, we really don't have any place else to go with it. We're, Mr. Chairman, Representative, as a municipal power agency, we're owned by our members, so any revenues we have go back to our members.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this isn't on this exactly, but I'll just note that the list of exemptions, this will move us up to a cool 100. I guess if Representative Backer's bill passes, this will move us back to 99. But just say, in terms of the expansion of just making the system complicated, this will add subdivision 100 to the list we had before. Just want to make sure to note that for everybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your tally, Representative Pinto. Okay, thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Peterson. Oh, that should have brought you to the front of line, Representative Peterson.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hertas moves House File 2998 to be laid over. Representative Peterson, welcome, and please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair Drazkowski and members. House File 2998 is about equal tax treatment for the 500 households living within the manufactured housing cooperatives. They are taxed differently than any other category of housing in Minnesota. These manufactured housing communities are located in Cannon Falls, Fairmont, Fridley, Lindstrom, Medelia, Moorhead, and Clark's Grove. There is seven communities. With this bill, taxpayers living in cooperatives would be allowed to claim the property tax paid on the land their home sits on to be calculated when computing and applying for a refund. And this reverts back to the way the law was previously in 2010. Manufactured housing is a cost-effective form of housing. To many, it's very affordable, but it's disappearing at an alarming rate. This tax treatment is just one contributing factor and a disincentive to other parts becoming resident-owned and using a cooperative model. This revenue note, as included in your packet, is $150,000 per year, and it's basically a one-time expenditure to get these people back to where they were before. And we just want to make sure that these manufactured homes are not singled out, and I do have a witness with me today, and it's Kevin Walker with the North Country Cooperative Foundation.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Mr. Walker, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Walker, Director of Business Development at North Country Cooperative Foundation. We're a small nonprofit based in Minneapolis, which since the year 2004 have worked with a number of these communities to help them purchase their communities through the cooperative ownership model. And ultimately, these what we're finding in the wake of what we see to be something of an oversight or a misstep in the 2010 session, we're having to explain right from the outset at our first organizing meeting of the residents that one cost of going cooperative is that they would lose access to the certificate of rent paid, which a number of the residents, especially the lowest income residents, qualify for on a sliding scale according to current tax law. So our role, again, is we work with willing sellers of manufactured home parks. We help them sell their communities to a cooperative organized of the residents. And then we provide ongoing technical assistance and support for all of the cooperatives with whom we work on an ongoing basis. The form that the ownership takes is that the cooperative owns the land. Essentially, they organize a new cooperative corporation, which they incorporate under statutes 308A or 308B. And that corporation then leases the lots in the park to the residents. So in this way, the cooperative model simply replaces what used to be an investor owner, typically an LLC or some other kind of entity, with a new single corporate entity. The difference being that this new corporate entity is owned by residents in the community that choose to join the cooperative. And I think the fundamental point there is that the cooperative corporation is still leasing lots in the community. Any cooperative attorney would tell you that they're signing a proprietary lease in connection with their membership agreement for the cooperative. And so in essence, you know, any of the basis and argument for a certificate of rent paid being issued to a renter and investor-owned community, that same argument, same situation still applies, even with cooperative ownership. So in working closely with House staff, we found the language, including in Representative Peterson's bill, to be the right language for resolving this discrepancy and putting these residents on parity with their counterparts in investor-owned communities in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Members' questions? Just one quick question. The 17%, Mr. Hines, is that inherent in law from the renter's refund calculation amount? Is that where that comes from in the summary? Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. It's the same 17% that we use for renters.
Okay, thank you. Questions, members? With that, Representative Peterson, any final comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This will really help make housing more affordable for people and also provide an opportunity to really the people who live in these communities tend to be elderly, disabled, or the working poor. And so this is really helping these 500 families now, but maybe potentially setting them on a pathway of home ownership in the future and helping several other families down the road. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Thank you for the goodies. Representative Hertus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just talking with Ms. Schill, but my presumption would be that these park owners that own the land, that the property is probably taxed at a non-homestead or a commercial rate. And then the rent that they charge these people are reflected accordingly. And now we're proposing, similar to the renter's credit, providing a 17% credit. So in addition to what you're doing in making ownership or housing opportunities affordable, maybe we should be reevaluating, since the end use of that property is for residential purposes, maybe the park owner should be taxed at a residential rate or a homestead rate, which would lower the burden of rent to those people.
Thank you. Mr. Walker, did you have something to say?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually, as it happens, in that 2010 session, and I don't know if it actually came through this committee, and I lost track of what the trail was, but ultimately it is already the case that manufactured housing cooperatives in Minnesota do enjoy homestead tax treatment in respect of their residential status as opposed to a commercial property. So the tax class rate is 0.75% relative to the 1.25% that an investor owner of the same community would otherwise pay. But again, this goes a step beyond that to resolve the issue at the individual household level for the renter's credit.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. With that, members, thank you, Representative Peterson, for bringing the bill. The motion, or the bill, is laid over. And with that, members, the meeting is adjourned.